Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our journalist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How are you doing?
Back.
I'm back. Yay. I almost couldn't hear you because the Hamptons wind is still blowing through my hair.
I can smell the salt on you. Academic and DJ, Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. And Pop Rocket's fifth Beatle. Welcome back, our beloved returning guest, USC professor Karen Toxin.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Hello, hello.
Channeling a little winter.
A little winter.
Somebody's got a hello, hello.
Exactly.
Every week we start the show by taking questions from a listener about our own pop culture taste. This week I want you to tell me, guys, what do you listen to in the car, subway, or bus on your morning commute to work or school? Implying that Angelinos take anything but their car to work is just preposterous. Karen, what do you listen to on your commute?
Well, I have a very short commute between my place in Echo Park and USC. So most of the time I listen to whatever's on the radio, meaning usually Ryan Seacrest and Ryan's Roses. And I like to kind of enjoy that, you know, sort of everyman's commute.
Ryan's Roses is just like it is a wonderful way of getting outside of your box in Los Angeles and remembering like how like what the rest of the world is doing. And the answer is cheating on each other.
Exactly. Broadcast universes elsewhere. And I'm just like always riveted. And I kind of never want to pull in the parking lot when that's on. But for longer drives, whenever I have to commute somewhere else or, you know, for pleasure or work, I'm always diving into these good food they're not podcasts. It's a show on KCRW with Evan Kleinman. And it's just like every possible nerdy food thing from, you know, this is a very rare kind of apricot that you can jam to, you know, sort of whatever Jonathan Gold's most recent reflections are on, you know.
Do you ever Lynn Rosetto Casper? Do you ever Splendid Table?
Yes. Thank you. You read my mind. I was just about to ask.
Do I ever what?
Do you ever listen to The Splendid Table?
Oh, I never listen to The Splendid Table. I mean, I only discovered listening to these food shows on like the radio when I was doing like a kind of longer commute to take care of a sick relative somewhere else, you know, like in Las Vegas. So at a certain point, I couldn't listen to music anymore because I was just like worn out.
Yeah.
And then there was something incredibly soothing, not only about, you know, NPR voices, but like, you know, discussions of every form of sumptuous meal, and also the kind of social responsibility angle on food and all that. You know, come on. It was a very conscious and learning experience for me to always listen to that.
I would recommend also on the food podcast tip is America's Test Kitchen does a podcast, which is fairly listenable, I must say. So.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oliver, what do you listen to on your commute?
You know, my commute's about 45 minutes each way, give or take. And so that's actually just about the right amount of time to listen to a podcast. So usually, and these days I commute on Mondays and Wednesdays. So Wednesday mornings, I usually reserve for the Savage Lovecast, which besides Pop Rocket is my favorite other podcast. And his shows are always about 45 minutes, but I always skip the first like 15 minutes of monologuing like I think most people do. I don't know why podcasts do that. They have these – I mean, Mark Maron is perhaps the worst case example, but it's like no one wants to listen to that for
sometimes
the most part.
Sometimes it's half of an hour before you get to
I'm
the
saying.
Interview. Fuck them. By the way, you guys, I'm going to start doing a monologue before we get to the panel.
And we'll
guys
just sit thoughts. Here and
where I just talk about my week.
You're going to do song cycles before every show. All Sondheim.
On the days where I've already exhausted my Savage Lovecast, what I'll do is go to the NPR app and either if it's in the morning, I'll look through the morning edition stories and basically program the ones I want to listen to. And then in the afternoon, it's All Things Considered. So and occasionally it's music, but oftentimes it's usually some kind of news content, basically.
Margaret Wappler, what do you listen to?
Well, I barely commute these days because I write from home for the most part for what I do. And
so you listen to Dave on your commutes. David. He hates being called Dave.
Right. Yeah. Don't get it wrong. Yes, I listen to my husband talking in various areas of the house. But mostly I think of commuting for me is when I get up from the computer and I start making myself lunch. And that's when I will listen to Spotify's Discover Weekly. I've been getting really into that lately. Mm. Every Monday, they refresh this Discover Weekly playlist, and it's about 2 hours worth of music. And the thing I really like about it is that it's new and old music. So the old music is based off of, like, whatever you're listening to. They'll select something that they think you would like. And then the new music is just also pulling from what your tastes are. So, you know, for me lately, like, they put in this great Heinz song, which is this band from Spain, and it was really great. They put in a Joni Mitchell song. It's like, yeah, you know me. You got me. And I also got really into this old Cocteau Twins song, Heaven or Las Vegas, from it that I had sort of forgotten all about. So I just love that I can listen to it and feel like I'm rifling in a way through my own old CDs that I no longer will rifle through in my house because it's a pain in the ass. So, yeah, Spotify's Discover list. And then also I've been getting really into Brad Listy's podcast called Other People, which is a literary podcast where he interviews different authors, both fiction and nonfiction, but he tends to go more for fiction people. And he's based in Los Angeles, so there's actually a lot of Los Angeles people that he talks to. And there's been people like Megan Dom, Hilton Alls, my friend J. Ryan Straddle, Carolina Wachlowiak. I mean, just really great, talented writers. And he also, you know, he is a person that does start with a little bit of monologue or a little bit of like personal touch to the interview. But I find it really compelling because he knows how to use silences really well. He knows how to use the dramatic form of like posing a question and then sort of being quiet and then answering it in this really confessional, raw way. So it's great.
I, in the morning, tend to just listen to NPR to find out what's going on and also, you know, what affirmative action processes in India are pissing people off these days. But I also will go to, like, in my head, I have sort of my podcasts that are regularly refreshed, like a Stuff You Missed in History Class, where you're getting, like, three of those a week. Or a This Day in Canadian History. Before a longer drive, like, that's when I go to, like, the Dork Forest or something where there are only going to be, like, three or four from the past month. But I have another kind of commute. When I'm driving to a show, I always listen to, like, a girl singing. Like, I just listen to something. Like, if it's a show that I need to, like, ramp myself up for, I will listen to songs that I will sing along to because I have, you know, my body is my instrument and I have to warm it up.
Mm-hmm. I did sing along to Borderline when I was driving here.
Really?
Borderline, yeah.
Yeah, you have to get yourself in the zone.
Exactly.
Thanks to Bryce Lee Wynn. Oh, he's one of our favorites.
Hi, Bryce.
In the Facebook group for that question. Coming up on this week's show is the VMAs, you guys. I'm going to formally say it. The VMAs are the end of Summer Jam season. They are the Labor Day of pop music.
We all have to not wear white anymore.
So, there were so many people dressed all in whites. So much to talk about. But first, let's find out what other arts and entertainment news or events have got our attention this week. Margaret. What are you all about?
I'm all about my vacation reading. So I read Emily St. John Mandel's Station 11, which is the most strangely hopeful apocalyptic tale I've read in a long time. Mm. What happens in the book, she's a Canadian novelist. This is, I think, her fourth book. And it's set around Toronto. And what happens is that this devastating flu from Eastern Europe comes and just like wipes out like 98% of the world's population. And the main character, Kirsten is part of this traveling band of performers. They perform Shakespeare. They also sing. And they go to these really ravaged towns where there are still some settlements of people and they perform. And it's all about their adventures sort of through this super decimated world. And it's just a very beautifully written, very beautifully conceived book. Like, on a sentence level, it's gorgeous all the time. And it is very sophisticated about how it weaves in these different strands of the story. There's a celebrity from Los Angeles that factors in. There's a cult leader that factors in. It's just so smart and beautiful, and I really loved it. And so that's something you can get at any airport around America.
What is it with Canadian authors and natural disaster?
I don't know. Well, who else? Are you thinking about Margaret Atwood?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Her preoccupation with, like, Canadian literature is about the concept of survival. But also, I think, like, looming specter of the United States being glamorous and taking attention is my favorite thing in Canadian novels, is this sense that, like, this is my story. I'm not that important.
Because there are cult leaders and celebrities.
Right. I mean, at one point, they do go over into what was the United States. And it just doesn't even matter anymore in this world.
Yes.
You know, there's no borders. It's completely porous.
It's because Scott Walker's wall didn't get built. That's why.
That's right.
Karen, what are you all about this week?
Well, I've also been sort of trying to cram vacation mode style through the last remaining bits of streaming, like, bingeable watching that I could do before the semester began last week. And, you know, I'm one of those people who's hailed by all these lists, like, this is everything that's going to be taken off of Netflix, like, immediately,
yes.
Right? And so it, like, stimulates my OCD and, like, pop culture completism all at the same time. And, of course, the kind of the most manageable bits end up being miniseries.
Uh-huh.
And so I've, like, binged on every possible one, the good, the bad. But the one that kind of stuck with me was the M. Night Shyamalan sort of don't call it a comeback miniseries, Wayward Pines, starring sort of a potato-looking bedraggled Matt Dillon, and my partner Sarah calls it Wayward Peens, which I was like, well, that's really more the tagline for men of a certain age. But anyway, she and I just got like looped into the show, which is about like a kind of Secret Service agent. The series opens with him having a car accident and being kind of stuck in this small town in Idaho. And at first it seems, okay, this is a quaint place to recover. But then it gets very Twilight Zone-y very quickly. And you realize that there's no real escape from this town and that this town holds the keys to our sense of a future and humanity and all this stuff. And I won't spoil everything in case anybody wants to run home and watch all 10 episodes kind of like I did. But there's some really great, I think, sort of plot devices. The twists aren't as overdetermined as, and nor are they as outrageous as, like, recent M. Night Shyamalan-y, you know, sort of ventures. And I thought it was a really gratifying watch.
So it was, I'm a little bit surprised that it was good just because I feel like that man hurt me so bad with so many movies.
Yeah.
Do you feel like he is somebody who was damaged by early success, who really got a rigid idea of what he should be doing?
Yeah, I think he's sort of just like, you know, bought into his own formula, or he was like kind of an early like self-brander.
Yeah.
And when you're doing that with kind of pivotal, twisty plot points, I think that you can kind of reach for the moon and fall really terribly. And so, like, you know, when I think about something like The Village, I'm just like, oh my, it's like, no, these are just essentially kind of Amish people or whatever.
Was that the crop circles one?
No, that was
Signs.
Signs.
The Village was, they live in the 18th century and cannot use contractions. And also there are monsters out in the woods.
Yeah.
But also... are they just in a Pennsylvania state park and they built this?
Just haven't found their campsite again.
Yeah.
Fucking Lady in the Water is the one you should get pissed off at.
Okay.
What, not The Happening? I mean, there's so many choices here.
There are so many choices.
Lady in the Water. Have you seen it?
No.
Okay. Fuck Lady in the Water. I would go into it, but we have better things to talk about. All right. This week... I am going to force all of you to listen to one of my stupid preoccupations again. The thing I'm really all about this week is my jam, and we'll get there eventually, and there will be a knife fight, and who knows what will how many people will leave this booth. But
I came prepared, I'll tell you that.
Margaret,
Shiv is sharpened.
I feel like I've talked about the prospect of your death far too many times over the course of the past month, and I'm sorry. But Canada is having an election on October 19th. And one of the things I love most in an election is gamifying, like an interactive gamified experience so you can sort of understand the election better. Has everyone here clicked through like an electoral map to be like, what if Pennsylvania goes this way?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, those are lovely and one of my favorite things to do during an election. It does not make sense for Canada because they have like 10 provinces of desperately different sizes. It's not winner take all. So, there were a couple of places. And the trouble with Canadian culture is so frequently that they're just doing a smaller version of what we do because America's done the innovation. Let's just do that. But like clicking through every writing to try to figure it out doesn't make sense because I don't know what's going on in all of these little places. So finally, the Globe and Mail like created basically a page to sort of like essentialize what the poll numbers right now mean, because it is a hard three-way tie between the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the New Democratic Party.
Yeah, I want to hear about who the main players are. I don't really know anything.
Okay. So you've got the current prime minister for the past 10 years, Stephen Harper, whose government relies on there being oil and oil being expensive. Okay. Oil is now not expensive, so he is struggling. And they've basically spent the past 10 years basing their entire economy on it. Justin Trudeau, the son of Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who's very attractive, very young, and not much else. And his party was decimated in the last elections because their political system is a mess. And if you have three viable parties in a country that runs elections essentially like we do, it means that you can have the same virtually identical poll numbers have really, really different outcomes. So, like, you can go from... Parties go from, like, running the country to having two members in parliament the next election. It's crazy. And then last election, this sort of, like, Western liberal protest party that is the thing that got them socialized medicine back in the 60s, it came hard, devastated in Quebec. Like, Quebec went for the New Democratic Party hard. And they became the second largest party, and everybody's like, could these guys actually run things? And right now it looks like they're going to get their first chance in history to actually run things. The thing is that this simulator basically lets you just click and then run a fake election really quickly. And it shows you how the same poll numbers with just a tiny, tiny bit of randomness can produce drastically different results. A conservative majority government, a government where, like, it's probably going to end up being some sort of coalition between the New Democrats and the Liberals, but it's fucking crazy. Anything could happen, and they're the seventh largest economy on the planet, but we pretend like they don't matter. And I love it. And you guys should go click a couple times. Oliver.
I might have mentioned this very, very early into our recordings, but one of the best shows I've ever seen that dramatizes how a parliamentary election system works is this Dutch series called Borgen that came out a couple of years ago. There's three seasons of it. All of them are completely worth watching. And it's about the first sort of, a Danish female prime minister. But you learn everything there is to learn about – well, I shouldn't say everything, but – It gives a good primer on how does a parliamentary, like, electoral system work, which from an American point of view, I was like, oh, I finally kind of understand this better now, and it might help, explain the Canadian situation.
So many people have told me to watch that, and I still haven't watched
great.
It. But the fascinating thing is that because they're getting so much media from us, they are getting political culture from us. And so they're saying right now, where's our Trump? Like, they're trying to have the same kind of like...
Oh, where's our Trump? Why don't they just take ours?
Yeah, exactly.
Please.
We'll ship them right over.
Right.
They're trying to get celebrity politics in a system that is not suited to celebrity
politics. Right,
because
you don't elect the prime minister. That depends on which party comes into power. So,
right, except in Israel, which is stupid. all right, Oliver, what are you all about this week?
I'm about all about Gizmodo and specifically their editor-in-chief, Annalee Newitz. Shout out to the San Francisco Bay Guardian because we both got our start there back in the 90s. But her and her team have been doing this amazing job.
Also went to Berkeley.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, did she?
Yeah.
I forgot.
She was one of the kind of cool kids who I used to like see in the hallways.
There we go.
The
All right. So Barry represent. And so Annalee and her team have been crunching the data from the Ashley Madison hacks. And unlike everyone else who are sort of doing it for more period interest and like, look who's cheating and look who's a hypocrite, which, again, that's decent work, I suppose. But she's really been what her and her team have been interested in looking at is how many of the profiles, especially of the females, women supposedly on the site are real. And what they've discovered so far is a completely concerted effort by the people running Ashley Madison to create as many basically fembots as possible whose sole purpose is to get men to spend more money there. And whether you call it legally fraudulent or not, it certainly enters into the gray area at the very least. And it's sort of just amazing in terms of all the details and that they've been able to find, including the kind of internal terminology that the folks at Ashley Madison use. So like angels is basically code for a fake female profile that is designed to lure in more men to get them to interact.
Angels, it's so creepy.
Or engagers, which is the other term that commonly gets used. And so, I mean, so far they've managed to find somewhere around 70,000 examples of these fembots that were created specifically to target straight men. As a kind of a side discovery, Ashley Madison may not have been a great place for men to have an affair because you'd be inundated with basically fake profiles trying to get at you. But because women and gay men were never really part of the target audience, Ashley Madison might have been a decent place for basically queer men and women to find each other because they weren't going to get, again, targeted by all of these automated bots trying to, get them to chat with them and spend more money and do all these other things. And so in any case, I mean, it's to me, it's really gripping reading because they're just diving deep into what the database suggests in terms of both their business practices, but as well, who kind of benefits or doesn't from Ashley Madison's tactics.
Occasionally during this whole thing, there have been people who have made side references to the notion of there being queer people on Ashley Madison. And really?
The new data in this recent piece, actually, where she reanalyzes the data after saying, wait a minute, I may have misanalyzed it in the beginning. Something like 14% of the female users who are non-bot users of Ashley Madison are actually seeking same-sex encounter with women. So that's 14% versus what the kind of national average of 1.5
or is that what it is?
Okay. Are we talking about ladies who are married to men who are looking to get... Okay.
Experiment or something.
Or looking for a threesome. But there are also other people, kind of just your run-of-the-mill women seeking women.
Well, I mean, I just didn't feel like it was a place where... gay people would go. It didn't feel to me like a place where gay men would go because we just use one of the apps that is for gay men to have sex. And there just isn't the same kind of, I'm married, so this is a different situation kind of thing.
Well, if you think about the whole lesbian seagulls we mate for life type of thing too, something like Ashley Madison might make sense for queer women.
Yes.
Who are interested in other configurations.
You're a lesbian. You should be able to just find an ex-girlfriend's ex-girlfriend and date her.
The L-word theory. Yeah. They're all connected.
Find a Shane.
One last side finding is they did discover instances where bots ended up talking to other bots. So basically,
amazing.
The algorithm. But how many instances did they find? They found 69 of them. Thank you.
Bot on bot.
We're going to shut down this
podcast.
We're going to shut down this podcast. It's reached its apex. All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about the VMAs after this.
Hi, I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller. And if you're not listening to our podcast, Baby Geniuses, you're missing out on stuff like...
Camille Nanjiani solving the Zodiac murders.
Would you ever go to a friend and you're like, hey, could you lick all these envelopes for me? You'd be like, you're a serial killer. I'm leaving right now.
Guy Branum talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And it was just a great moment of oh no, I'm here, boys. I'm on this side of the bench.
Megan Amram talking about intimidating baristas.
Just feel like they're always in character. They're always in character as cool hipster girl. Mm-hmm. And I just want to break through that barrier.
Plus, every week we explore a new Wikipedia page and talk to a crazy expert in the field of nonsense.
Well, any hack can make you not have a boner. I mean, it's about how you do it.
Right.
And we're the only podcast with regular updates about Martha Stewart's pony or your money back.
We're not going to give them their money back, are we?
No.
Let's keep it.
Yeah.
Listen to our show every other Monday on Maximum Fun.
Yay!
Yay!
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are Margaret Wappler.
Hi.
Oh, you guys are supposed to say your names.
Oh, right. With me Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
Karen Tongson.
Okay. Well, this week was the official end of summer music season, the VMAs. And before we actually talk about this, we should just briefly note, I was a consultant for a week on the VMAs. So
He picked all of Miley's outfits. I just want people to notice.
You were responsible for the rainbow Dolezal weave.
That one was great, and I was watching it during dress, and I got to see so much of Miley. You were talking about the rainbow cardboard thing. I was talking about the rainbow Skittlesy thing.
Oh, I was talking about just the rainbow iterations of the Rachel Dolezal wave that she was wearing throughout the broadcast.
Let's just note, this is my job, so I will talk about it as though I were a viewer, but I will try not to use anything I know from the inside to be critical of it. And also understand that this is, we're a little bit different from Slate Culture Gabfest and Pop Culture Happy Hour in that we're in Los Angeles. All of us are in various ways content producers, but also two of us are journalists, and so we have obligations about
conflicts of
interest, and this is an ongoing discussion that we are having internally to figure it out. So just understand we're figuring this out, and respect. All right, you guys. So the VMAs were, I thought that they were a good show. I thought the performances were good. I thought it tried to make moments, and it did create some authentic moments. Thoughts?
Start with the upside of my experience with it, which was really difficult because I was like, oh, how do I get it to stream, et cetera, since I'm a cord cutter. But anyway, I actually thought Miley, despite the many critiques that she received for, hosting or her throwdown with Nikki, did a great job and reminded us that she was kind, she's a show person. She was born in a trunk.
Well, and also fucking, those years on the Disney Channel or Nickelodeon or whatever it was.
Yeah. Just, Disney Channel, yeah.
They shine through. I mean, yeah. when we were watching her during rehearsals, just sort of realizing she's a fucking pro and she knows how to do this. And also, there's the way that being the child of a celebrity lets you go through being a child star without getting kind of... Your parents' mortgage doesn't rely on you. So I feel like children of celebrities can be more self-possessed when you're around Miley's age.
Well, she knows the business, and she made reference to that actually as part of her efforts to sort of, change the tone or in the encounter with Nikki. Like, she's very much about, the business of show.
Right.
And I think that was, and she kind of pulled that off, pulled her hosting off, I think, with a kind of aplomb that most people aren't giving her credit for.
Also, I think she played to her strengths in understanding part of being a female host of an award show is fucking costume changes. And one of her focuses was, I want as many costume changes as I can, so every time I come on camera, it is a new moment. And I thought that that's something we don't think about dynamically as content. We think about monologue jokes, but she basically said, I'm not good at monologue jokes. Not that she said that, but she focused on a strength, and I thought it worked beautifully.
Yeah, I agree. I think she did a good job hosting, particularly since it was her first time. Mm-hmm. It was strange to me. I read a couple of reviews where people talked about how awkward she was. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just a fan of Miley, but I found the awkwardness charming. I found that she was just playing off of it a bit. Even the moment with Nicki Minaj where Nicki calls her out was clearly like a staged thing in my mind. I mean, Nicki smiled. Nicki smiled. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It seems,
But see, I think, to me, it felt staged too, though Guy has assured me it was not. But I'm saying, but it still felt staged, so I don't know what that means.
I mean,
that's an interesting comment.
The thing is, I would not be surprised if, the opening number was, Nikki healing the bad blood with Taylor. She's got to have something to be going on right now. The notion that this was produced doesn't require that it be produced by MTV and the VMAs. I think it is far more likely that Nikki's brand camp was like, you need to do something, and Miley has talked shit at you, so make this happen.
But it felt to me almost like a wrestling moment. Do you know what I mean? When the wrestlers kind of are like, yeah, I'm going to get you. And it's just pure theater. I don't really think those two women are like, there's some bad blood there.
I think it shook Miley. I legitimately think that
she looked pretty shaken. I thought, she was trying to play it off, but her facial expression in that.
If she was prepared, if she was prepared for it, she would have had a better response.
Yeah,
I actually think her response was okay.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was staged. It's like, wow, you just kind of pulled that out of the air. Okay,
right?
Yeah.
It was an adult response, but she would have had a zingier response.
Exactly. She would have had a response that.
But that would have furthered the conflict. She was clearly trying to just nullify it.
But I mean, if it was produced, wouldn't she have tried to further the conflict in some way? Like, I do think that this was Nicki Minaj, like, I mean, to some extent, Kanye-ing, you know, to some extent, sort of like making the moment about her. I mean, even.
At least she didn't take 10 minutes to do it, though.
We'll get there.
Yeah, we will get there.
The opening, like, my favorite numbers were the opening number with Nicki and Taylor, just because, like, we got to watch that three times in dress rehearsal, and it was...
It looked great.
Like...
The costumes were great.
The costumes were great, like, and just having it be a symbolic moment of, oh, look at these two, they're on the same stage. So great. And then I deeply loved the Macklemore, the Macklemore...
Downtown.
Okay,
I feel like we got to go in on that sigh now.
Well, I think you're going to talk about it later, so we might not want to get into it here.
All right, we'll hold off on it. What were your favorite performances?
I like the Pharrell Freedom performance a lot.
I did too.
I loved his whole getup. I loved the dancers that he had with them. I think that one and the ending Miley Cyrus number were my favorites. I loved the ending number.
Really?
Yes.
Because I thought that was a thud. Like,
why?
Okay. So the whole time I was there, I mean, you're just constantly running into queens from Drag Race, and I was plotting.
Yeah.
I thought that the song was bad. I thought that...
Oh, I'm not even talking about the song. I'm talking purely performance.
And what's interesting is watching them dance on stage from the theater, I was like, what is this? But watching it in two dimensions, those costumes popped in a way that they didn't three-dimensionally.
Huh.
Like, I think those costumes were brilliant.
Because
I think that's why I was so taken with it. I really thought it was great.
It was puppeteering, essentially.
Yes.
Like, and what's so funny is at the pre-show, there was this weird 40-year-old guy wearing a, like, rainbow tuxedo and no shirt. And I was like, who the fuck is this?
Oh, the designer. That's
Jeffrey Campbell, right?
Yes. And
it was,
and then when I realized it was the guy who had made all of those costumes, I was like, okay, never mind. You're right. I'm wrong.
Yeah, I love that they were... It was puppeteering, and it also reminded me of, like, the just this 90s London rave vibe at the same time. Mm. I thought about Delight.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, there was definitely a connection there to me, and I also love that she collaborated with Flaming Lips. I thought that those were, like, the right people to bring into that performance.
Yeah.
I also want to say, like, of Montreal, that band has been doing that whole spectacle for a long time, and I hope she gives them credit.
Oh, I would just like to say... like, it was interesting watching her intros during our dress rehearsals, because a couple of times she made hints about maybe having some sort of relationship with the Flaming Lips guy.
Green Coin?
Yeah.
Really?
And that was interesting.
There's quite an age difference there.
And then Colin's looking at me. Am I allowed to say these things? I don't know.
It's like, bleep, bleep.
But then...
this will be cut.
The other thing is, the sheer quality... I wasn't watching closely enough because I was having to go out and wrangle, Jenner girls. but, like, her intro for Jared Leto... all, like, repeatedly referenced that they had sex with each other, and it was, they were the best, including the person I had my first lesbian experience with.
I noticed that,
and
then I was just like,
yes.
That's Jared Leto. Also, because I was just like, I didn't recognize him at first.
Yes.
Yeah. But you didn't like the song because it was just like, I smoke pot, I'm into peace, like, just because the lyrics were pretty innate.
I'm not a hippie.
I mean,
yeah. It's like, you kind of are doing a hippie thing, actually, Miley.
And it just wasn't as dance, like, it wasn't just as fun and danceable as some of her best stuff is and can be.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a really good, like, she's a really good pop artist. And I just sort of wanted something that was better. I mean, though, the minute she said that album was available and for free, I was like, boom. Like, that's exciting. I want that. Oliver, what were your favorite or least favorite performances?
I mean, like Margaret, I really like the Pharrell song. It's going to be, I mean, preview is going to be my jam for the week, so I'm probably going to be saying some of the same things in a few minutes. But partly just how it builds. And I think musically it was the one moment in the night that really just stood out to me just because of how long it takes for it to build through that little kind of piano bit until it sort of reaches him beginning his vocals. You know, I kind of go back and forth on Downtown. I think the chorus ultimately wins me over, but I feel like it's two different songs that have been awkwardly mashed into one. And the part where Macklemore is actually involved in, I'm less interested in. And I also don't like the Freddie Mercury clone. But somehow, like, at some point, hearing them sing Downtown over and over, I kind of feel that moment of it. So I thought as a performance, it was well choreographed and it was sort of spectacular in the way that the video was. And that kind of worked for me.
Realizing that they were going to try to hit so many of those dance beats at a live show.
Yeah.
Was really just sort of like, oh, wow, they're completely recreating the open from this. All right, let's see how this goes. I thought that the Demi Lovato performance was a disappointment.
Surprisingly stiff.
It was very try too hard.
Yes.
Linda Holmes on Twitter was saying it felt competitive. And the thing is like, look, Britney showed up. At that point, you're seventh tier diva. and you're also you're not getting to perform in the studio. Mm-hmm. So I thought that she was trying to bring it in a way that she kind of couldn't back up, and also it's trying to make the song that really should be about gently caressing another woman's face like an outside woohoo. Like it showed its weaknesses as a summer jam in the most sort of like visible of ways. I also just didn't like her wet look hair.
Well, the style of the performance or the kind of anxiousness behind the performance remind me of Adam Lambert's first Grammys performance a little bit, where he would just like, you know, was kind of like in some sort of, you know, plunging neckline bodysuit, like licking everyone on stage.
Yes.
And I think that even though Demi didn't do that, you know, there was
just
some, like that
hard.
That feeling was radiating over the entire kind of show.
Tori Kelly, I thought, did an amazing job of doing something that was stripped down, a voice and a guitar, in a situation that is very production heavy.
Yeah, I agree. It was all performance for her. That was anchoring it entirely.
Yes, and she during rehearsals would just sort of like hit that last moment and like vocally riff, and it was glorious to like listening to her just randomly sing. And then Bieber during off moments during rehearsal would just randomly sing, and it was lovely. It was truly lovely.
I've also heard Bieber sing just out in the wild, and it's shocking that he's actually really good.
Yeah.
No, he's actually my favorite performance of the evening.
Uh-huh.
Insofar as that, you know, whereas, you know, the kind of Demi Lovato's trying too hard wasn't that kind of gripping emotionally or appealing, there was something about watching Bieber try to get something back in that performance.
Yes.
That to me was actually kind of moving in his little, you know, breakdown at the end. I think that was very earnest and sincere. And, you know, as you were saying, it was because that he was his junk was strapped and all of that, like, flying gear. But I actually think that, you know, I think he's really trying to make a, you know, he's in a weird growing pain moment. He's trying to mature to the next level.
Yes.
And there's something about both songs, actually, which I really quite like, but that to me sort of sound like early Chris Brown.
Yeah.
And that seems like a move that, you know, I think kind of makes sense, you know, at least musically, if not, you know, spiritually and everything else for the Biebs.
There was something so wonderful about watching all of the girls who had fought with each other over Nick Jonas and Justin Bieber in 2007. Like,
triumph.
Triumph while those boys are showing up trying to prove that they have validity in any way.
Yeah.
All right. Two other big things we need to talk about. First of all, the phalanxes of Taylor Swift's friendship.
Somebody needs to make a giant wall chart at this point.
You will be assimilated. Like,
yes.
there
we all are.
I'm
going to
get a wall mural of like Taylor and her posse.
Ellen Pompeo.
On little thumbnails for each one.
I am always going to love shit like this. And the fact that we went from Taylor Swift saying, I'm not a feminist, to this transformation of her, like, that we're now at 5 years ago, our pop stars were fighting to see who could melt down the quickest. Now it's like, well, which one is a better intersectional feminist? Like, you know, Miley was tone policing. but like, I do think that there is something lovely about it. And you can bitch about, like, it was all skinny white women and Soraya. Or you could also look at it as somebody got up in front of a bunch of 17-year-olds and talked about the essence of what feminism is, and in a way that was triumphant and cool. Thoughts?
Well, I think that this was, like, the VMAs was, like, Taylor Swift's, like, Hillary Clinton diplomacy moment. Like, she was, yes, like, I'm going to diplomatically win the VMAs. I'm going to, like, you know, I'm going to end
It's a diplomatic victory on civilization.
Exactly. I'm going to end, you know, my beef with Nicki Minaj. I'm going to finally make peace with Kanye by introducing him.
And, who was like, repeatedly a dick to her still. He pretended to be asleep during her award, her acceptance for Blank Space.
Oh, see, I missed that part.
Okay.
Yeah, but you know, but I think that she was on a diplomatic campaign. I think that she is seeing herself as this kind of venerable, like, Secretary of State, the Secretary of State of Pop. You know, it's a sort of... And then, and she has her army of lovers.
She gave Joseph Kahn time to basically thank the people in the crew. You never get to see director, which is kind of odd for the VMAs, for Video Music Awards. You don't actually get to hear from the directors of the music videos, but she gave Kahn time. I'm like, oh, there's a kind of a nerdy Asian guy there making Asian mom jokes. I kind of like that.
Hanging with Taylor.
But this goes back to your point is, and the thing about Taylor Swift is I'm looking forward to when her era is over because I don't like someone who's so hard to dislike. Like, I don't trust that.
Yeah.
I don't trust that shit. So,
and she brings a lot of, like, wasp polish to her
she
delivery.
Does. And,
well, the thing is there is something fundamentally unmessy about what she is trying. Like, she dislikes Nicki Minaj yelling because it is upsetting the status quo. And I get that, and part of me is judgmental of the waspiness of it. But I also, there's something just so 15-year-old girl, can't we get along? Like, there's something so sad about it.
Yeah, she wants everyone to get along, but then she's also willing to completely apologize. I mean, she did have her complete apology to Nicki Minaj, which is also a diplomacy, an act of diplomacy, in a way that you don't see other pop stars willing to embrace. Well, I mean, I'm almost getting, like Oprah vibes off of her at this point. Like, she could have a talk show in like 5 years when she runs out of the pop sector.
Okay, off of Oprah, just realizing the extent to which Oprah, like, Janet Mock talked some sort of shit at the VMAs, and then Oprah tweeted, I just texted you. And the notion of them being girlfriends makes me so happy.
I'm so happy. I want to see the text bubbles.
Yeah.
But Taylor's, like, I have never seen as many photos of adoring gay boys getting an actual elbowy hug from a pop star as I have with Taylor Swift. She seems to try to create authentic moments as much as she can, and that may be inauthentic, but I love the place that it's coming from. And, you know, I love that Mariska Hargitay was at the VMA.
Yeah.
It's very weird and random, and I will not be happy until both Margaret and Karen have been brought up at a Taylor Swift concert.
I give it six, inside 6 months.
Working on it. Working on it.
Part of the spot. Off of Taylor, I mean, Taylor managed to be her night by having her have splashy moments with people who she had had beef with or had beef with her. So her, like, her presenting the Video Vanguard Award to Kanye, it wasn't as amazing as it could have been. It should have been a moment where somebody else was presenting it. She walked up, grabbed the mic from them, and said, I'm going to let you finish. But she would never do anything that messy,
right?
I'm sure. Not that I have inside knowledge about that. I don't. But now am I protesting too much? Point is, what did we think of that moment and of Kanye's acceptance?
Well, I thought she was incredibly gracious to him in her warm-up for him to come on stage. I mean, she was completely lavishing praise on him. She got in a little bit of her, like, iTunes bonus by saying that was the first album that she got on iTunes with her brother. right, cha-ching.
Someone at Tidal's very angry at her, though. But anyways.
It's true. And Spotify. They're like, damn it. I thought she was super gracious. But I have to say, once he got on stage, I mean, I enjoyed the speech as a spectacle overall, but I was really aggravated that he couldn't just apologize to her in a completely 100% owning up to it way. Like, why did he have to get all the way up to the edge of the apology and then just scatter?
Because I don't think he's really sorry.
But why isn't he? He interrupted her. That's just basic manners. Well, why not just say you're sorry?
I think he was trying to say something more profound about the kind of structural racism of award shows and whatever in general.
Sure, but I mean,
that's partly why.
It was sort of a bigger blast of the same sort of the Nicki thing. And the response to that tends to be, but that's rude, mostly from nice white people. and sort of, you know, it was weird to have such a politicized VMAs where, like, nothing, like, I mean, just there were a lot of mentions of Black Lives Matter that were brought by the artists, you know, and other stuff. But yeah, there is this point of he was trying to make a point about structural racism in award shows in the way that we sort of
the
like.
The music industry.
Yeah.
I think that it was just sort of, you know, as.
But like, then he, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No,
I'm just going to say, he didn't even own his own point, though, about, like, the sexism of interrupting a woman while she's accepting an award.
Right.
He started to say that. He started to frame it that way by talking about his daughter.
Interrupting someone else's daughter, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I just feel like, I don't know, I'm not seeing him pull it both ways.
The need to conceive of misogyny in terms of someone else's daughter
right.
is something
that
makes me want to stab. She's a person because she means something to a man.
Right,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
I can't deal with that logic.
look, I mean, it is, I don't know or understand, like, Kanye's greatness. I'm not that familiar with hip-hop, but, like, there is just sort of, like, a formless dickishness that he brings to the world.
Yeah.
Like, having him get up there and, like, there had been talk that he might perform, and having it just be 15 minutes, like, who else gets to do that?
Right.
Like, what do you think of this announcement of a run for the presidency?
I mean, in general, I said this on our Facebook group, you can be self-absorbed and you can be, or you can be incoherent. You just can't do both. Because one of the two can be entertaining in and of itself, but trying to combine the two, you know, I don't know what to make of the presidential run. Was that some kind of, you know, callback to like the Bush? Who knows what that means? But I just felt like it's not like his speech was had no gems to take from it, but it's like you could have just said it a lot faster, something along those lines. It just didn't. There was no moment there to it, except for the fact that, like, wow, what the fuck am I watching?
There was something. Yes. There was something beautiful about, however terrible it was, a moment of television where you knew you had no idea what was going to happen. The people in charge had no idea what was going to happen, and it only was because he was bringing this cachet of sort of like unquestionable fame to it that there was that level of complete deference, and that was wonderful to watch.
I mean, if I can just add, I generally don't watch the VMAs and or really music award shows in general, which is a little odd perhaps for music journalists of, you know, 20 years. But part of it, it's because I love pop music and I'll defend pop music to the death. I don't like pop stardom. And to me, the VMAs encapsulates basically everything I detest about how pop stars are expected to act and how they deliver upon those expectations. And to me, I mean, I'm not going to pick solely on Kanye because there were many moments throughout the night that I think could speak to that. But that to me just reinforced like why I don't generally watch the VMAs to begin with is that I don't need to see like there's nothing that doesn't add anything to my appreciation of music is to see like artists whose work I respect, you know, act asinine or act incoherent or whatever you want to describe it as.
I like a nice narrative.
Well, I like the human drama of an award show, and I like, you know, I like the kind of improvisational dramas and the star texts that kind of radiate from them. And I think that it enhances my appreciation. I think the most profound moment of Kanye's acceptance speech was really just the silence and the moment of humility at the beginning with a roaring crowd and, like, you know, that kind of extended period of not saying anything.
Was that humility?
Yeah, I was going to say, though. I don't know.
Maybe I feel like that was just, like, basking, like, give it to me.
Or a little bit of both, you know?
We need to wrap things up, but just a quick moment for fashion. Like, there were some interesting choices. I hated Demi Lovato's dress, but... Mm. There was also one of the most interesting moments I have had in recent past was Amber Rose walked in and she and a girlfriend were wearing dresses that were white and basically had sort of like slurs for women all over them, but like a variety of slurs. But she also had two gay guys with her who were wearing black outfits that just had faggot repeatedly written over it in white. And a coworker who I had been like, is he gay? I don't know, the entire time, immediately hit me and like directed with his eyes to that. And it was just such an interesting moment of realizing like the emotional violence of a moment like that, of somebody having a hard reaction and sort of needing the other gay guy present to sort of like acknowledge that this thing was happening. And it was a thought-provoking garment that made me go to a place of like, that person is gay. He is allowed to access and control of that word. But it is still striking and shocking here, and also a little bit weird from gay guys who are existing entirely as accessories to Amber Rose's outfits. And like, after parsing all of that, I had to come to a point of like, all right, you made me think, outfit. I will accept that from you. Did anyone else have any strong reactions to anyone's clothes?
I love Nicki Minaj's dress. I thought it was just the perfect combination of like racy and classy.
Yes. Also, like the entire design of that number with her and Taylor Swift was great. Though Taylor Swift's outfit there was a little saloon to it.
Yeah, I was actually like transfixed by Kim Kardashian's like militarized,
yes,
like,
yes, burlap sack her, of a like, maternity dress.
Her military maternity dress.
Well, also,
like, wow.
I mean, the thing is when she is so curvy that when she gets pregnant, she turns into an oval. And there was something really lovely about seeing that, like, she's Kim Kardashian. She can own the sexualization of that in a way that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. Oliver?
I mean, in general, I liked Miley's various incarnations of the different outfits. And, you know, my wife, who was sitting next to me watching, after the third outfit, she just basically stopped saying, what the fuck is she wearing? She realized, oh, this is just going to keep coming at us one after another. But it might have been sort of focus grouped to death in terms of let's maximize the, you know, the kind of outrage impulse. But, you know, at a certain while, it's sort of like going to, a 13-course tasting menu where you just don't know what they're going to serve up next. And you're kind of excited to see what comes out.
Well, and also, like the risk of a labia might pop out is part of the theater of the moment.
Yeah, I think I spent at least one or two camel toes during the course of the evening. So.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Yiro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's internet court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Karen Tongson,
Margaret Wappler,
Oliver Wang.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we will be asking our panel, what is your current jam? Karen Tongson, what is your current jam?
Again, I'm in total back-to-school mode, so I need a lot of inspiration and something to kind of get me bumping to campus and through campus. And I've been revisiting a lot of, you know, my new wave boyfriends from the 80s in that kind of effort to, like, channel some sort of youthful energy for myself. So this week, I went with Spandau Ballet's Chant Number 1, which to me always felt like a deeply kind of sleazy, like, it has some kind of crazy shout horns and, you know, kind of funky primitivist beats, or at least Spandau Ballet's interpretation of what that would be. And so I'll always remember the video that opens with Tony Hadley's, like, kind of sweaty, moist lips. And just, like, to me, this song is just sort of, like, at once motivational but also really deeply dirty. Mm-hmm. So let's listen a little bit to Chant Number 1. That kind of vaguely orientalist guitar riff. I mean, there's so much of that in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Was just,
interesting that this spells back to school to you.
Well, it's like, I don't need this pressure on.
Gotcha.
Anyway, now you can hear his, like, sumptuous, kind of loungy.
Yeah, there's definitely a little lounge lizard to it.
Exactly. He was very lounge lizardy and ambiguously gay. So, mm-hmm. Like, sort of always shocked me that Spandau, none of them were gay. But, yeah. Anyway.
Oh, I mean, Britain in 1985, you were...
Yeah, it was all gay.
You were either voting for Margaret Thatcher or gay in some way. Margaret, what's your jam?
Well, in honor of my Hamptons trip, I listened to a lot of Beach House, you know, for obvious reasons that connect to the band's name. But also because I really love Victoria Legrand's voice. I feel like I could just listen to this woman sing Tax Code. It's just so gorgeous and pillowy and whipped at the same time. So this song is called Space Song, and it's from Depression Cherry, their fifth album. From an empty sea, a flash of light. It helps if you have a cocktail on the beach while you listen to this.
Yeah, I can see that.
Not totally required, though. Yeah, it's super washed out. They, like the Hamptons, are also living in like a constant Ralph Lauren ad, where everything is just like soft and leather and burnished and beautiful. And I really appreciate that these guys are such committed stylists. They basically have this formula and they're just not getting off of it, but they're plucking new things out of it.
Margaret, based on your taste in music, yes. I would assume that 80% of your life is spent reminiscing about lost loves.
That could be true. Depends on the mood, you know?
Oliver, what's your jam?
First of all, I just popped my collar in homage to the Beach House kind of Hamptons prep style. Mm-hmm. I already mentioned this earlier. I spoiled this earlier in the show, but my jam of the week is actually Pharrell's Freedom, which came out about a month ago. And I probably gave it a quick listen back then, but I didn't really seriously listen to it until it was at the VMAs the other night. So. Hold on to me. So after, it feels like, 2-3 years or summers in a row of Pharrell turning out either literally entitled happy songs that have that kind of happy pop flow to it.
That SpongeBob song was good as fuck.
Right. It's kind of nice to hear him do something that's a little bit just darker in tone and more engaged in terms of its social messaging, which I don't even really need the latter part. I just like hearing a slightly different style from him. And people have pointed out that this song bears some resemblances to sort of the classic 90s house song Hot Music by Soho, because it has a sort of similar riff. But to that I say, great. Like, that's a great riff. If you want to play with it and you're not violating certain copyright laws, like, go for it. And I sort of just like the kind of tenseness that Freedom brings with that just repeating refrain that you hear there.
I really love that we have a protest song that you can dance to. And it sort of speaks to the interesting moment that we are in, that it sort of is like the late 60s, early 70s, where there was such – it was such a cultural moment and there was so much commentary happening that it existed in a lot of different forms. It wasn't just that one song. Mm. And it did sort of remind me in a very different way of the way that, like, Nina Simone hits all of these different points where, like, you know, Mississippi Goddamn is the best song because it's funny and it's terrible, but it's funny. And that I really love about this, because something like How You Talkin' 'Bout is like, have you guys heard that?
The Janelle Monáe.
Yeah, it's Janelle Monáe, just sort of like repeatedly saying the names of people who have died, black people who have died at the hands of the police in the past 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it is chilling and powerful, but not an earworm of the sort that this is. And it's such a wonderful song. Any other points? All right, let's fight. my jam this week is Downtown by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Okay, so when we were writing copy for the show, I had to go through and just like watch everybody's videos to sort of like figure out what was going on. Also, I just need to point out that the song with the social message that Jennifer Hudson was nominated for is also a W ad. Like, it is a gay marriage song that is also a W ad. But I watched the Downtown by Macklemore, and Everybody in the room was sort of like talking shit about it. It's five different songs. It is, you know, it's so sellout and weird. Why is it about mopeds? And I was like, all right. And then I listened to it again, and I was just sort of like fascinated by it. I was like, what? What is going on here? What is going on here? Why is he singing this way about mopeds? And then I remembered my very good friend, Karen Kilgariff. We were one time having a conversation about Queen, and she said that when she was like a teenager, the thing, she was like, why did he sing this way about a bicycle race? And then I was like, mopeds, bicycles, let's do some investigation. The extent to which this song is an homage to Queen and 80s glam rock and also early 80s rap. And is sort of, it's Macklemore imagining what Walk This Way could have been if Freddie Mercury had had enough T-cells to make it. But I also feel like it is I just started going through the lyrics and becoming obsessed with the way that this is an articulation of an aesthetic for Macklemore. It is Macklemore saying, I am not going to rap about Bugattis. Bugattis? Is that how you say it? Like, yes. I'm not going to talk about how rich I am. I am doing a different thing. Like, this is the different thing that I am doing. And that it is, like, the confluence of different cultures. Like, and in sort of using downtown as this place of sort of like mixing of cultures and interaction between cultures, because you guys, it got layers, tiramisu. Let's hear some. Hot place throwing fish to a fire. Downtown. And everyone can agree that they love this, and everyone can agree that, who is this guy?
From Foxy's Shazam.
Eric Benelli.
Yes. Everyone can agree that they like that, and it is poppy. My first reaction to this song was Macklemore will die with more Tonys than he has Grammys.
I know, it does have a very musical theater vibe.
Yes, and I did that as a rote insult because I thought we were supposed to be insulting the song, and the more I thought about it, I was like, I mean, we got pissed at him for writing that song where he talked about gayness, but also now he's doing a song that's doing gayness. That's like doing gayness and sort of trying to wrap that in with 80s hip hop, and that is interesting and compelling to me. Karen Tonkson, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, okay, first of all, I sort of agree with Oliver insofar as, you know, like with all of Macklemore's songs, I actually prefer the moments in the songs when Macklemore himself is not participating. So, you know, I liked Mary Lambert's part in Same Love, and I enjoy the kind of theatrical, aspirationally Queen-like moments of this song, although I think it never achieves Queen. It just hits slightly south of fun. You know? So, I mean, I think that, like, you know, those kind of, yeah, I think that the kind of hyperbolic comparisons to Freddie Mercury, I think it's more like, the, you know, that dude, whatever, Nate Russ or Roos or however you say it. And I came to the conclusion, actually, after seeing this video and listening to this song, that, I mean, Macklemore is kind of a genius artist, but he's really probably the best novelty artist who's kind of recording and making it big on the charts right now. I mean, he's a real kind of novelty guy. He's got a shtick for every song. It's your thrift shop. It's then, you know, then gay marriage becomes a shtick. And then, like, then you have the moped and the downtown and the moose heads and the tiramisu crotch grab, as I refer to on the group page. And so, I mean, I think that, like, yeah, I mean, Macklemore is doing something interesting. And I think it does veer into, I don't know, the kind of the novelty and a bit, and in that sense, a bit too pandery for my taste.
Okay, here's my point. First of all, if it's pandery, why is everybody talking shit about it? Second thing, there's something interesting about the way that he is just unrepentant about declaratory hipsterdom. Like, he is unrepentant about it. And I do think that, like, he gets a lot of hostility for not like, for integrating the things that are an organic part of his life and the lives of many of the people who are listening to this stuff, and making that text within the stuff that he is writing, as opposed to treating hip-hop as a safari park experience of blackness. Like, instead of him sort of, like, enacting the tropes that you are supposed to enact in hip-hop, he is instead saying, well, what if this is about you know, what if this is about my world? And not in a 21 Pilots, let me whine about the suburbs kind of way.
Yeah, but I do think he actually gets a lot of props for being, you know, for doing his kind of theatrical shtick.
And yeah.
For being, I think that he, I mean, look at all of the awards he's won. And like,
yes.
He gets a lot, tremendous amount of industry respect, I think, you know.
Right.
It's just, you know, the sort of people downtown who don't necessarily respect what Macklemore is doing. And I mean, you know, his stuff is listenable, but it's just not compelling to me because a lot of it does feel a bit insincere, honestly.
Okay.
There's sort of an interesting side debate that's happening, I've seen, around the fact that he does bring in Kumo D, Grandmaster Melly Mel, and Grandmaster Caz, who are three of the greatest old school MC legends. And, you know, because Macklemore's never really had, you know, most self-described hip-hop purists just don't embrace him for a variety of reasons, his whiteness being sort of one of them. And there's kind of this interesting debate playing out where people are arguing back against that by saying, well, at least he brought out Melly Mel, Caz, and Kumo, and no other, you know, what rappers do that anyways? And so, which to me is sort of, I get, you know, I'm certainly not mad at those three guys getting checks, like, God bless, like, yeah, they deserve that. But just because you do it doesn't suddenly give you this sort of insulated insta-pass of not being maybe whack in other ways. So I'm not offended by Downtown. Again, I'm not really sure I really like the song for any reason outside of the kind of theatricality and the novelty aspect of it. It's sonically, it's just two different, completely different songs.
Oh, you mean it's multiple different songs? Not unlike, say, maybe Bohemian Rhapsody? I mean, which this song is an homage to Queen, it is deep, and people want to take this as a fatuous song that is not textured, but there's layers to this shit, tiramisu. Which is...
Do not besmirch the name of Bohemian Rhapsody by comparing this song with that song.
But I also think some of the Fun's anthemic songs that like ramble around are tighter and better than this.
Yeah, this is two songs. It's not like, you know? It doesn't take you through a suite of 18 different movements. There's like the Macklemore part, and then there's the Eric Nally part, and the twain don't really meet to me.
No, I would say that there is a third part, that when those guys from the 80s are rapping, it is a third and different voice.
Okay.
Okay, Oliver, I have a question for you. In reading criticism of this and previous Macklemore, there is frequent use of the word corny, which I think has acquired sort of it is a term of art within hip hop. And to me, there is a way that I have heard corny used in application to this and also in application to People that makes me question if it is in some ways a gender expression code word, you know?
I mean,
spell that out for me.
Okay. Basically, that it is a word that is attempting to point out inauthenticity or expression that is wrong, that is used in application to somebody being flamboyant or declaratory in a way that is not acceptable,
like,
to hip-hop, that isn't masculine enough. And there's this one... We've all read AV Club's hate song, right? That's where comics bitch about a song that they hate. Mm-hmm. I talk shit about Radiohead for no good reason other than to troll people and piss off Margaret. But one time this comic, Joe Mandy, talked about Same Love, and he kept using the word corny about it. And then he talked about how he only listened to ignorant rap. And so you can take it how you like. And there's just a way that I feel like particularly white fans of hip-hop are critical of Macklemore for not essentially treating hip-hop as a distanced magical world of awesomeness and big cars and, you know, polite homophobia that's just allowed. Like, that him trying to sort of, like, draw in these other cultural elements is questioned a lot. And God knows, we all need to take three or four good looks at any time a white person is trying to walk into a traditionally black art form and say, like, well, let me fix this. But also, I'm never going to, the argument you're treating gay people like they're human beings, that is disrespectful to rap, isn't an argument that's going to work very well with me. And this song isn't textually gay in any way, but its texture is about glam and about a very different kind of expression. And I feel like that's where some of the hostility comes from.
Okay.
Is Macklemore really hip-hop, though? I really don't think he is. I think of him as just purely a pop star who uses hip-hop language to a certain extent. And those, I mean, I think of him as being about as much hip-hop as Taylor Swift was country, like, an album ago.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where he's just using some of that language and some of the signifiers of what hip-hop is. And I think that's fine, because at this point, it is utterly mainstream. It is totally released into the atmosphere of all music. Do you know what I mean? So I don't quite understand this idea that he's like not legitimate accessing that, I guess. I just don't, I don't know. I'm not seeing it. I mean, some of his sentiment, I know with like Same Love, yeah, I didn't do it perfectly, you know? But I also, I feel like he's genuine.
But also, he did it. Who the fuck else was doing
it? Exactly.
Who the fuck else did it? Yeah, and the thing is my reaction to Same Love was, ugh, I mean, they'd never let one of us do this. But it was also, I'm listening to this in a barbershop. Like, I'm listening to talking about why gay marriage is a good thing in, like, a barbershop where I would never hear Mika, you know?
I have many thoughts on that. But that, you can just, like, Google my name and Macklemore and you'll find them. But I do want to say something about the corny, because I live for corny. I come from a nation that has been defined as corny.
Yes.
The Philippines. And I think that there is something attached to that that's not only related to gender in Macklemore's case, but also to the fact that he comes from Seattle, or a.k.a. the provinces, in terms of the entertainment culture.
Yes.
Right? Because corny is somewhat, you know, kind of old-fashioned or out of date, or a little bit behind the times or out of style. And I think, you know, that's probably also part of why he kind of gets dissed in the way he does around corniness. It's precisely because his sense of style is attached to kind of a peripheral space or the boondocks. Or, you know, not that Seattle is necessarily, right. but I think that in the kind
of... But Seattle and Portland both have a cultivated sense of boondocksiness. Like,
yeah.
the way that they're...
Aggressively boondocksy.
That their aesthetic is trendy right now is the boondocksiness of it.
Yeah. There you go. That's
finish your point. Okay. Finish your point, Karen.
Oh, I don't think I had much more to say about that, other than that, you know, I can just see corniness applying to that element of Macklemore, as well as what you're saying is a kind of code for like kind of failed gender performance or sentimentality in some way.
I appreciate, right. though, that in that song as well, that if, you know, if he is going to be working with these hip-hop tropes, it's not about money. And it's not about bitches. It's not about fame. It was like in a much more sort of like soft, reverential way to, you know, these MCs of the past. I don't know. There's something about that was actually like sweet and refreshing.
Well, I mean, the song is very deeply about sort of like these things were about simple pleasures, like that that the Sugar Hill Gang were talking about, like the quality of macaroni, and the Queen was just talking about fucking a nice leather seat, and that we've gotten removed from that. And I think he is making a hard argument that that is what he is about. And look, it is suffused with hipsterdom, and I deeply hate so much hipsterdom, but I think I hate hipsterdom mostly when it is hiding behind the authenticity of something else. And he is making an argument for, no, this in and of itself, which I think is a little bit dangerous and is one of the many reasons that the song makes me cry. And it probably shouldn't, but I am just weeping emotions at all times. You guys, this is always a good time, especially when Karen is around. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me back.
We love having you.
My seersucker shorts in honor of Margaret's return.
Oh, yes, love it.
You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with
Karen Tonkson,
Margaret Wappler,
and Oliver Wang.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Bemused, Name 99, Smitty Smith 9999, Chemo Test. Dustin with a V, Blue Girl in Red State, and Jacob Ryan for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. It helps us do better on the iTunes charts, and it helps us to be better as a show, and we appreciate everything you guys have to say. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group, and this week tell us, what do you listen to in your car, subway, or bus on your morning commute to work or school? We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the corny Colin Anderson and Ibarianx Perello.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.